something has changed in my relationship with my cat. Because I had like a, we were a little standoffish around the time that my new cat, you know, had to be neutered. He started peeing all over the place and pooping on the place that, and something went sideways. When he was old enough to eat Smalls, everything changed with the cat. He now like will come up to me. He'll sit on top of me. He purrs. He like wants to like rub his face on my beard, which I'm okay with that. And I don't know if it's because of the Smalls, but I know he loves his Smalls. This podcast is sponsored by Smalls. For a limited time, you can get 60% off your first order plus free shipping when you head to smalls.com/majority. Smalls cat food is protein-packed recipes made with preservative-free ingredients that you'd find in your fridge. And it's delivered right to your door. Super easy. That's why cats.com named Smalls their best overall cat food. And starting with Smalls is easy. You just share info about your cat's diet, health, and food preferences. Then Smalls puts together a personalized sampler for your cat. You don't have to pick between random brands at the store. Smalls has the right food to satisfy any cat's cravings. My cat, he loves, well, he loves anything that's like the chicken or the turkey, but it's the broth. Smalls also has extras like this broth that you can put into the food and it just supercharges it.
Put it on the wet food and makes it not wet anymore.
And on the dry food,
yeah.
And the other thing is that you know, cats sometimes they don't drink enough water, and so it keeps them hydrated. If you're still not a believer in Smalls, Forbes ranked Smalls the best overall cat food, while BuzzFeed said my cats went completely ballistic for this stuff. I don't know why you would believe BuzzFeed over Matt and I, but whatever. Smalls also has a bunch of amazing treats and snacks you can add to your order. It's like a little holiday gift for your cat. After switching to Smalls, 88% of cat owners reported overall health improvements. That's a big deal. You know what I've noticed? And I don't know if it's, I think it, his poop doesn't smell as bad. I mean, I'm not, whatever. And the team at Smalls is so confident your cat's going to love their product. You can try it risk-free. That means they'll refund you if your cat won't eat their food. What are you waiting for? Give your cat the food they deserve. For a limited time, because you are a Majority Report viewer or listener, get 60% off your first order, plus free shipping when you head to smalls.com/majority. One last time, that's 60% off your first order, plus free shipping when you head to smalls.com/majority. What do you have to lose, folks? Check it out. All right, and now it's time for the show.
Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Wednesday, December 10th, 2025. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Kalena Tom Have, Pittsburgh-based independent journalist on inequality, on home care workers losing their minimum wage protections under the Trump administration. Then, Senator Bernie Sanders, Senator of Vermont, author of Fight Oligarchy on the Oligarchy and More. Also on the program today, a third federal judge approves unsealing of the Epstein documents. We'll see if Trump's DOJ will actually do it. Democrat wins Miami mayoral race for the first time in 30 years. In a special election in Georgia, a Democrat flips a state House district that had been dummy-mandered, one that Trump won by 13 points. Trump on an affordability tour plays the very, very tired hits. Republicans in the House to end its boat strike probe because they never really cared. In the Senate, Republicans will offer a bill to replace Obamacare subsidies with a one-time payment that goes into health savings accounts that will cover maybe a tenth of what those Obamacare subsidies covered. The U.S. to subject foreign tourists to social media history review. Trump regime to shut down a Biden-era student loan cancellation for about 7 million people. The EPA is wiping mention of human-caused climate change from its website. In Illinois, Pritzker signs a law banning immigration arrests at courthouse, limits info given to ICE, makes it easier to sue those federal agents. Lastly, 25-year-old glyphosate safety study retracted after it was discovered that the study was written by Monsanto. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks so much for joining us. Emma Vigeland out today, although she will join us for the Bernie Sanders interview. We interviewed him yesterday afternoon, and we will be playing that after we speak to Kalena Tomhave. So Donald Trump is on an affordability tour because, which is sort of fascinating. Did they bill it as the affordability tour?
That's what I read on Fox.
And you'll recall that he got sick of the word affordability. No, I'm sorry. Day one after Mamdani wins, we've got to talk more about affordability. Then day two, I'm sick of affordability. We're not talking about affordability. Then yesterday, Donald Trump heads to Pennsylvania out near the Poconos at the Mount Airy Casino Resort. Because he's a man of the people.
Cost of living is so bad at these casinos.
So he head to a casino. It was a venue of about 600, 700 people. And he's out there, you know, wanting to talk to the economy. Because, you know, here is News Nation is interviewing some Pennsylvanians. And this is what they say about the economy.
We're still struggling, even when we have our money coming through. We had to suffer going almost a week with no food.
I mean, food prices are up, but I think gas is down, coming down. I think things are getting a lot better.
The economy's down the tubes. Healthcare is awful. Prescriptions are terrible. Groceries are off the charts. And I think the only way we're going to do better is if he gets out and somebody else gets in.
Now, the second guy definitely was like a hardcore Trumper and was just had to admit, incidentally, gas prices are not down. Nevertheless, here is Donald Trump. He hears these people. He knows what they want. And he addressed it very much. We're going to play number three. Go ahead.
And we had a meeting, and I say, why is it we only take people from shithole countries, right? Why can't we have some people from Norway, Sweden, just a few? Let us have a few. From Denmark, do you mind sending us a few people? Send us some nice people, do you mind? But we always take people from Somalia, places that are a disaster, right? Filthy, dirty, disgusting, ridden with crime. The only thing they're good at is going after ships.
Okay, how many people in that audience, I think, even know what Somalia is? I don't think they had a clue.
Could find it on a map.
No, and so he...
I've seen the Tom Hanks movie about the pirates.
Incidentally, only 700 people in that venue. 700 people. There were more people at the Mamdani satellite election parties in any given one of them than were in that place. And so he doesn't get the rush that he wants from saying Somalia, because they're all like, wait, none of those people have met anybody from Somalia. They don't know. I mean, with all due respect, I suspect, like, you could put one person from Somalia and one person from Norway, and a significant portion of those people would not be able to tell which country they came from. So he's got to get a little more explicit, and here he does with number four.
Please raise your hand. That's for Minnesota, you know. That's called the Great Big Minnesota Scam with one of the dumbest governors ever in history. I love this Ilhan Omar, whatever the hell her name is, with the little ching, the little turban.
Ching.
I love her. She comes in, does nothing but bitch. She's always complaining. She comes from
a
country
for one
where...
second. Can we just look at this?
I'm sorry. This feels racist against white people. Come on.
Just go back a little bit. I want you to look at the guy in the back there with the white hat. When Trump says all she does is bitch, okay, this guy has finally been heard. He has been dealing with this for his full, whatever it is, 25 years. Go back just a little bit. Watch his reaction. Go ahead.
Bitch. She's always complaining. She comes from a country where... I mean, it's considered about the worst country in the world, right? They have no military. They have no nothing. They have no parliament. They don't know what the hell the word parliament means. They have nothing. They have no police.
Pause it for a second. With all due respect to everybody in the audience, how many of them know the word parliament? Can you explain to me?
Excuse me. Cigarettes?
Can you explain to me a parliamentary form of government? Go ahead.
Police themselves, they kill each other all the time. I love it. She comes to our country, and she's always complaining about, the Constitution allows me to do this. We ought to get her the hell out. She married her brother in order to get in, right? She married her brother.
Easy there.
Can you imagine if Donald Trump married his sister? Beautiful. She's a beautiful person. If I married my sister to get my citizenship, do you think I'd last for about 2 hours, or would it be something less than that? She married her brother to get it.
Hold on. Can you imagine if, for instance, I married my hooker and that's the way she got citizenship? Or if I dated my daughter, just for a moment, imagine if I dated my daughter. Think about that. I'm going to think about that for a second. give me an hour or two and think about me, like, dating my daughter. Hot she is, and I'll think about that. Think about that for a minute.
Imagine if Rudy Giuliani married his second cousin.
Oh, yeah. Can you imagine if he had multiple affairs? Can you imagine that? That would be, oh, God.
Do you think I'd last for about 2 hours? How long could I last? Something less than that. She married her brother to get in. Therefore, she's here illegally. She should get the hell out. Throw the hell out. She does nothing but complain.
Nasty.
wait. Put that back up. Does that shirt say Persians for Trump?
I think it does say that, yeah.
Do you know how many Iranians have been rolled up by the Trump administration on this immigration thing? Like, the guy standing right there, go get him.
Yeah, well, I'm not talking about Iran or Persia. I'm talking about Iran.
Unbelievable.
That's PBD's fault right there.
So there you have it. That's Donald Trump's response to the affordability crisis in the country. Brian was saying that it's like watching Andrew Dice Clay still doing his routine sometime in the late 90s, maybe early aughts.
It's like a half-filled club.
He's at the VFW. Oh, what's going on? Oh, why is everybody so old?
I used to play Madison Square Garden. Oh!
We'll play a couple more clips of Donald Trump. He seems very energetic. 2 days after the day that I have it down that he gets juiced. I don't know.
Let's go do some racism for the yokels.
Okay, come
casino.
On. I'm feeling it. It's going through my veins. We get out there, play the hits again.
I don't think the guys behind him holding bigger paycheck signs, like, no one sees that, you idiots.
Have you seen videos of Frankie Valli lip syncing in his 90s? that really is what
that,
it's like.
That would be amazing.
This is, I mean, it's out there.
In a moment, we're going to be talking to Kalena Tomhave. She's a Pittsburgh-based independent journalist on her piece on the home care workers losing their potentially losing their wage protections. First, word from our sponsors. I don't know about you, but I have so many things on my to-do list that it's insane. Particularly around this time of year, but just about any time. And so if there's anything I can put off, and maybe because I feel like I'm intimidated by it, I will do it. But there are some things that you need to get done and don't want hanging over your head. And, of course, your trust, or particularly your will, is something you don't want to put off. Trust and Will turns estate planning from a when-I-have-time task into a quick, straightforward process, ensuring you're protecting your family's future today. Go to trustandwill.com/majority. Get 20% off their simple, secure, and expert-backed estate planning service. I did my will after my first child was born, and but it took a long time because at that time, they didn't have anything like Trust and Will. You had to go see a lawyer. It was intimidating and this and that. I've been through this Trust and Will process. It is super easy. It is literally like filling out an easy survey. Super easy, very straightforward. And I am telling you, once you get your will done, if you have kids or you have family or any assets that you want to give to somebody, it is going to feel like you have the greatest burden lifted off of your shoulders. Their easy-to-use website is easy, and it's simple to navigate. All your information and documents are securely stored with bank-level encryption. Each will or trust is state-specific, it's legally valid, and it's customized to your needs. It's got an overall rating of excellent and thousands of five-star reviews on Trustpilot. The peace of mind alone is worth it. Add some peace of mind to your future with Trust and Will. Go to trustandwill.com/majority for 20% off. That's 20% off at trustandwill.com/majority. Put the information in the podcast and YouTube descriptions. Also, around the time of this year in particular, you may feel a little drained. Long work weeks, busy weekends can leave you and feeling and looking depleted. ProLon's 5-day fasting mimicking diet works at the cellular level to rejuvenate you from the inside out. providing real results that include fat-focused, sustainable weight loss with no injection needed. And now they're up in their game with the Next Generation 5-Day Program, delivering the same science-backed benefits in a cleaner, more convenient, and more flavorful format. ProLawn is a plant-based nutrition program featuring soups, snacks, and beverages designed to nourish the body while keeping it in a fasting state, which triggers cellular rejuvenation and renewal. It was developed for decades at the USC's Longevity Institute. It is backed by top U.S. medical centers. ProLawn has been shown to support biological age reduction, metabolic health, skin appearance, fat loss, and energy. The ProLawn's Next Generation, you get everything you need from a prepackaged and ready to go. Each order of ProLawn's 5-day program comes with 5 boxes labeled by day so you know what to eat each day. Next Gen builds on the original ProLawn with 100% organic soups and teas, a richer taste, and ready-to-eat meals. I did this last year, and I'll tell you, I was very nervous about it, but I was super interested in this idea of the longevity stuff. And it was actually not that hard. I did the show. I had as much energy as I've ever had. So actually, I would probably even argue a little bit more. It is weird. You go through different cycles through it. And it keeps you in this sort of like a fast, like in this, it's like fasting, but with food. And it really was sort of exciting to do. For a limited time, ProLawn is offering listeners 15% off site-wide plus a $40 bonus gift when you subscribe to their 5-day program. Just visit ProLawnLife.com/majority. That's ProLawnLife.com/majority to claim your 15% discount and your bonus gift. ProLawnLife.com/majority. And lastly, we're headed into holiday party season. There has been one thing that I drink that keeps me from having a miserable next day if I've had some drinks the night before, and that is ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. It is the world's first genetically engineered probiotic invented by PhD scientists to tackle rough mornings after drinking. Here's how it works. When you drink, alcohol gets converted into a toxic byproduct in the gut. It's the buildup of this byproduct, not dehydration, that's to blame for rough days after drinking. Pre-alcohol produces an enzyme, and it breaks this byproduct down. All you got to do is make pre-alcohol from ZBiotics your first drink of the night. Drink responsibly, and you're going to feel your best tomorrow. This is what this is how the next morning after Zoran won, we were covering it here. We were indulging a little bit. The first drink of the night for me is pre-alcohol from ZBiotics. When I go to a holiday party, when I go to the holiday party I go to one. It's what I drink beforehand. If I know that I'm going out for a big dinner, I will do that. I feel the difference the next day. I don't feel miserable. Make the most of every toast this holiday season. Don't forget to bring the pre-alcohol along for the ride. Go to ZBiotics.com/majority. Learn more. Get 15% off your first order when you use majority at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with a 100% money-back guarantee, so if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they're going to refund your money, no questions asked. Remember to head to ZBiotics.com/majority. Use the code majority at checkout for 15% off. Quick break. When we come back, Kalena Tomev. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. Emma Vigeland out today. I want to welcome to the program Kalina Tom Have. Sorry, I just asked you that. She's a Pittsburgh-based independent journalist writing for Capital in Maine about the prospect of home care workers losing their minimum wage protections. Kalina, let's just start with, like, what historically, just give us some history on home care workers, because this has come up over the years. There was an attempt to unionize them, I think, 5-6 years ago, maybe more. I can't remember. Time has escaped me. But give us a little bit of background and welcome to the show.
Thanks. Yeah, thanks for having me. Sure. So domestic workers have struggled a lot to win worker protections over the past century, essentially. So domestic workers were one of the groups of workers that were excluded from federal labor protections. As many people know, in the original New Deal, domestic workers being, of course, mostly Black women in those roles. And then fast forward a few decades, and in the 70s, when care workers were brought into the Fair Labor Standards Act, there was an exemption put forth for companions. The idea that a companion is someone who just provides fellowship and a relationship, protects someone, and that they kind of like watch them, a babysitter, essentially. There's an exemption for care workers if they were considered companions. And so essentially,
what was the theory behind that? I mean, and we should say, I just, want to just sort of fill some of this back in. You know, part of the sort of trade-off to get the New Deal passed was essentially to exclude professions or jobs that were mostly filled by African Americans. So, like porters on trains also were left out. And that means no Social Security pay into wage protections in that respect. So what was the theory by having like companions at that time?
Yeah. So I think the idea, at least if we're looking at it kind of graciously, is that a companion is someone who is just like giving social time, right? Like maybe they live with you and they keep you from being isolated. You might also think of like one-off babysitters. A babysitter wouldn't be protected under federal labor laws. But the problem is that the companionship exemption was notoriously exploited by care worker agencies who classified care workers as companions. And they continued to do that for decades until 2015, when the Obama administration made the definition much more strict and made a rule that third-party agencies couldn't claim it.
This is like, I mean, I think like this type of stuff operates almost, I don't want to say subterranean, but people are not aware of just sort of the ability of the Department of Labor to change a couple of sentences in their regulations and completely change the fate of millions of people who are working. These are 3 million. We're talking about 3 million people across the country, right? Go into, you mentioned in the piece that the Department of Labor is reversing this, and basically like tell us what the actual implications are going to be for, and what percentage of these 3 million people are basically now going to be swindled. It's essentially being swindled out of their wages.
Yeah. So I should say it is a proposal. It's expected to be enacted. But actually, as of July, the department is actually acting as if it's already been enacted, even though it hasn't officially been put on the rules. They have completely thrown out the original definition that I was talking about, that the Obama administration put back in. But essentially, what's going to happen is that these 3 million people are going to lose their federal protections, and the protections will fall to their state. And so fortunately, about half of the states do have some form of state overtime or minimum wage protection for home care workers, but half don't. So
give me a sense of, like, I just want to take a wild guess here.
Yeah.
Are those states that retain the protections, who have higher standards, are those mostly blue states?
They are. They are. But you'd also be surprised, like you were talking about with just a few sentences. So Oregon actually instituted a domestic worker Bill of Rights recently, put in all these rights for workers. But in the Bill of Rights, it says that overtime and minimum wage protections will match the federal rate. So in Oregon, they're also going to lose protections, though they passed a federal Bill of Rights. They passed, not a federal, it's Oregon. They passed a state Bill of Rights for the workers there. So it would have to go back to the legislature.
And I guess my guess would be they just assume that the feds would not reverse themselves in the way they did.
Right, exactly.
And so these folks, what I also find, well, let's also just talk about this. There's these changes are, you write, part of a suite of 63 deregulatory actions by the Department of Labor. Give us a sense of, like, what some of those others are. But I would imagine, before you get to that, let me just, I also imagine that these people, this is, there's sort of like, I want to say a shell game going on here, because the story that the Trump administration will tell us is that you have immigrants taking Americans' jobs and bringing down wages. A lot of these home care workers are immigrants, and many, at least a significant portion of whom now, I mean, like, there's a lot of pressure on this group of people. And it almost feels like they're being lobbied by these associations, these agencies that provide the home care workers. They know that there's going to be pressure on their wages to go up, right? Because there's going to be less home care workers available, and they are basically foreclosing the opportunity for those wages, for their upward pressure on wages to happen.
I think that you could make that conclusion. Sure.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say that it just kind of seems like a ticking time bomb too, with all of the changes happening in care work, with Medicaid being cut, with more and more people needing care work. This rule going to lead to more turnover. It seems like a real problem.
Tell us a little bit more about the suite of 63 deregulatory actions.
Yeah, so I imagine that there's many more than that, but that was in one day in July. They dropped 63 deregulatory actions, the Department of Labor, and they really run the gamut. There were some COVID emergency resolutions that were reversed, some respiratory protections for workers that were loosened, OSHA restrictions for certain industries like construction were loosened, things like that. Basically, just a bunch of deregulation in favor of big business, and that's kind of the MO of a lot of the executive branch, right? I know when this suite came out, they talked about how for every rule put forth, they want to roll back 10.
Right. What, so if they have changed the language on the federal level, like, are these corporate providers of home care workers, are they now, like, paying like the state level minimum wage or no minimum wage and providing no overtime pay? Is that basically what's happening, or are they waiting for it to become more official?
Right. So it's not official right now, but what the Department of Labor did tell their investigators to do is to stop investigating any instances of wage theft based on the companionship exemption, based on violations of it. So it's not official, but
there's no enforcement mechanism. And if you and I know there's no enforcement mechanism, certainly these corporations know there's no enforcement mechanism. How do, if I'm in a state and I'm getting underpaid here, is there I still imagine like I have a legal, I could still sue, right? I mean, theoretically, even if the federal government is not enforcing it.
Privately. And you could also go to your state. And especially there are a lot of states that are actually really concerned about this because they're concerned about the level of wage theft complaints that they are now going to get since workers won't be able to go through the federal government.
I know, so they've got to ramp up.
State of Pennsylvania. Yeah, the vast plurality of wage theft investigations that they do are in care work.
And what about unions? Are unions moving into this area? I mean, I don't know if they have the it's very difficult to unionize under what's going on, obviously, with this Trump administration. But is there any attempt to organize these people?
Yeah, it's also really difficult to organize care workers in the first place since they're all in separate private homes. But there are a lot of unions doing good work. SEIU has unionized a lot of care workers, United Domestic Workers in California. They've actually already pushed back against the proposed rule, and they got the state legislature to put overtime protections in place. Wage protections were already in place, but they were able to solidify those state protections, those protections at the state level. So California workers will be protected thanks to the unionized workers there.
Are they are the unions? Do they anticipate this lasting? Like, I mean, if Donald, if J.B. Pritzker is the president in 2028, do they expect it to go back?
I mean, it's hard to say, and I don't really want to speculate, but I think that it would be likely because this is clearly like this is a change that came about directly because of lobbying by home care associations. Essentially, they were lobbying the Department of Labor directly, and it's something that domestic workers have worked on for decades. Even those who aren't unionized, the National Domestic Workers Alliance has done so much work to organize workers. One of the workers I talked with is not unionized, but she's an organizer with the National Domestic Workers Alliance. And they've put pressure on state governments and the federal government for decades. And so I want to say that I think it would go back if the executive changes.
Well, we'll see. Kalena Tomhave, we will link to your piece in Capital Maine. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, and we're going to be interviewing a Senator Bernie Sanders, who is we interviewed him yesterday afternoon. Emma and I both participated in that interview, and we're going to take a quick break. We'll come back with that. We are back, Sam Seder, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. It is a pleasure to welcome, I think, back to the program. It's been quite a while. Senator
Prior
Bernie,
to my time.
I think so. Well, yeah, maybe even the as the podcast. Senator Bernie Sanders, Senator from Vermont. Thanks so much for being here.
My pleasure.
Let's start with, we are recording this on Tuesday, but on Wednesday in the House, they're going to be voting on the NDAA. Wanted to get your sense of what is going on with our military spending. We the House is actually pushing for $8 billion more than Donald Trump is asking. It feels like that's been going on for years now, where Congress is sort of outstripping the president's request for more money for the military.
This is, it has been going on for years, and thank you for raising the issue. It is not talked about enough. So when we talk about the defense bill, we talk about this aspect of it, we talk about that aspect of it, but we don't look at the bill in its totality, which is to say that when you add everything up, what's in the defense authorization bill plus other military spending, we are spending over $1 trillion a year on the military. This is something like nine times more than all of, it's more than the next nine nations combined, including many of our allies. And it takes place when we have the highest rate of childhood poverty and senior poverty of almost any major country on earth. So it's an absurd priority. Primarily, it's a gift to the military-industrial complex who make all kinds of money.
You know, we just interviewed somebody who wrote a book called The $1 trillion War Machine. From your perspective, where is there a weak link in terms of like beginning to move this budget in the opposite direction? I'm old enough to remember the peace dividend that we never really saw.
What is sad, I mean, not shocking, you know, if people know my views, is that Democratic leadership cooperates with the Republicans. This truly is a bipartisan effort to give huge amounts of money to the military-industrial complex. I think the antidote is to have a national conversation, any movement, which is determined to change our national priorities. Several years ago, and I helped write the American Rescue Plan, in one bill, with one provision, we cut childhood poverty in America by 40%. One bill, one provision, all right? So it's a question of getting our priorities right. We don't need to be spending more than the next nine nations combined. What we need to be doing is investing in our people, in childcare, in education, in infrastructure, not just more money for the military.
And you can see how these are connected. Not to bring it back to the election, but I do think it's important when we're reflecting and speaking about how the issue of, say, you know, the genocide in Gaza, for example, and the way that young people were completely disaffected by that. When I got into politics, it was in part because Obama was in opposition to the Iraq War, and that galvanized me as a young person. In terms of reorienting our national priorities, where do you see the Democrats going in both connecting the income inequality piece to this, but also in terms of repairing broken trust about the anti-war energy that's so important in bringing young people on board?
Well, Emma, thanks for that question. I mean, there was once a time, and I'm old enough to remember it, where a significant percentage of Democratic elected officials stood strongly against unnecessary military spending. And I fear that that is not quite the case. Many of the Democratic establishments are worried that they're going to be soft on defense, et cetera. And of course, it ties in not only to the horrific support that we have given Netanyahu and the Israeli military, tens of billions of dollars over a period of years to destroy the people in Gaza, but it speaks to the military literally out on the streets in American cities today. One might think that when you have the president of the United States for the first time sending U.S. troops into cities in America, somebody might say, wait a second, why are we putting more money into the military? That's a little bit too radical a concept for many of my colleagues.
Senator, I want to just reference your book. Spent the summer into the fall on an anti-oligarchy tour. You wrote a book on the more or less the same topic. From your perspective, and I know in 2016, you entered the race and much of it was like getting money out of politics. The Supreme Court has, you know, as far as I can tell, shut the door on that prospect and very well may be opening it up to even more money going forward. What do you see? Again, this is another sort of like broader question about breaking this cycle. Like, what do you see? Is there a sequence? Like, how do you tackle the oligarchy? What is there anything that needs to come first?
I think, Sam, ordinary Americans, and not just people who are inclined to be Democrats, understand that this country faces fundamental systemic crises, okay? Not small stuff. What does that mean? I mean, it's what my book was about. And by the way, if I may say so, it's a good book. And what it talks about, what we do not as a nation talk about, but people want to hear more about, is the fact that you have a handful, a small number of extraordinarily wealthy people. Elon Musk now owns more wealth than the bottom 52% of American households. Now, just deal with that. One guy, more wealth than the bottom 52% of American households. Don't you think that might be a subject of enormous discussion and debate? The outrageous nature, the inequality of that, the power that goes to that. Meanwhile, Musk, again, spends $270 million to help Trump get elected. And then you have these guys, the autocrats, doing business in Saudi Arabia, Qatar. So what you are seeing is a global oligarchic movement where a handful of the wealthiest people all over the world, in a sense, are dividing up the planet. You cannot run away from that issue. It is insane that the top 1% owns more wealth than the bottom 93%. Billionaires are flourishing, never done better, and 60% of Americans in the richest country on earth are living paycheck to paycheck. All right, so I don't want to proselytize here, but am I missing something in suggesting that this is an issue of enormous importance?
I don't think you're missing anything. You're preaching to the choir here, but back to just a little bit about where we go in the future with the Democratic Party, you know, I'm encouraged to see there be this coalescing behind the buzzword of affordability. It's the step in the right direction, but oligarchy versus affordability feels like kind of the fault lines here.
Don't be naive on me here. I mean, that's just a poll-driven word. What do you mean?
Fair enough.
What does the establishment mean? Oh, yes, right. Trump is driving up prices. Terrible. Vote him out. All right, that's fine. But what do we mean? It's affordability is not just the fact that Republicans are resisting extending the ACA tax credits, which means that premiums are going to, on average, double for 20-plus million Americans. That's a disaster. But when you talk about affordability, you tell me how many establishment Democrats are asking the simplest of all questions. What's the first question you ask about healthcare? Duh. Why are we spending twice as much per person on healthcare as the people of any other major nation, and yet we have 85 million uninsured or underinsured? Is that not the first question you might ask? That's affordability. All right? That's not quite a question we are happy to ask, because you know what? You got to start tangling with the insurance companies and the hospitals and the drug companies. So let's stay away from that issue. We'll stay with the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, which is a disaster, frankly. So you got prescription drug prices. I mean, we've worked very hard on it with some success. In some cases, we pay 10 times more than other countries do for the same exact drug. That's an affordability issue. You're going to have to take on the pharmaceutical industry big time. So my suggestion is we got to make it more than just a poll-driven slogan. We got to go further. Housing, all right? What do you do about housing?
Wages.
I got to tell you, yeah. I underestimated this problem. I got to admit that. In my state, it is unbelievable, but it's all over this country. You're seeing working people paying 50% of their incomes for housing. That's insane. All right? So if you're going to talk about affordability, what do you do? How do you build millions of units of low-income and affordable housing? Those are the issues we've got to be tackling.
Is there, I mean, it seems to me that the problem with the oligarchy is that the money that they have, differences in this wealth disparity translates into political disparity. So how do you break that cycle? It's one thing to say we're going to fight the insurance companies, but it's also tricky to fight the insurance companies.
Or AI, artificial intelligence as well. Okay, so what do you got to do? First of all, I mean, I think, as you indicated earlier, this Supreme Court decision on Citizens United has done more to undermine American democracy than any decision, I think, in American history. So one way or another, we got to get rid of it. And you're seeing states moving in the right direction. Right. New York City, for example.
We
got to get around this issue. We cannot allow billionaires and their super PACs to buy elections. And it is getting worse. All right. One of the issues that I have been talking about, very concerned about, is the impact of AI and robotics on the economy and many other things. All right. I think what you're asking is how, in fact, do you take on a group like Ellison and Musk and Bezos and these guys combined worth, you know, hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars? And they start their super PACs, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that has got to be a major political issue. If I'm running for office, I say not only am I not going to take corporate PACs, we got to address the fact that we have a corrupt, and that's the word, campaign finance system. And you want to get my vote, you're running for office, you want to get my vote, you got to be have way up on your list of priorities ending this corrupt campaign finance system. But ultimately, Sam, all of these issues, the economy, campaign finance, AI, healthcare, require a grassroots political movement that is prepared to take on the big money interests that fight for working people. And I'm happy to say that in bits and pieces and here and there, we are making progress. Mamdani's victory in New York, Katie Wilson's victory in Seattle, those are not small things.
And do you think, in the, I'm going to assume that you're not running for president in 2028, but please correct me if I'm wrong. But be that as it may, do you feel that we are at the point now where advocating for a Medicare for all is what it's going to take for a candidate to win the Democratic primary this year? Or I should say in 28, this cycle.
Look, it is no secret. You know, I get all over the country, and when the crowd is not at 30,000 and it's a small crowd, I ask people, I say, you tell me, is the American healthcare system broken? Yeah, it is. Everybody knows that it is broken, okay? You cannot go around defending the Affordable Care Act when rates have soared, and in many ways, it's just a subsidy for the insurance companies, all right? So we need to move in an aggressively different way. I believe Medicare for all is the way to provide cost-effective universal health care to every man, woman, and child in this country. I think more and more people understand that. And just in the last few weeks, we have two new co-sponsors in the Senate. Chris Van Hollen and Tina Smith came on board. We're up to, I think, 18 or 19. They got 100 or more co-sponsors in the House. So we are making some progress, but we need to do is make sure that in any serious campaign, and I do that, if I endorse somebody, almost always that person is going to be supporting Medicare for all.
It speaks, I think, to a broader problem here where so much of what the Democrats are offering or are not is defensive. It's about defending the Affordable Care Act. It's about saying we're going to maintain a certain system. And when the system is as what we say, where we're at gilded age levels of income and wealth inequality, you sound like you are defending the system that's immiserating people, and Trump sounds like he's changing things.
You got it. I mean, that Emma, that's exactly right. Look, Trump, in essence, when he runs for president, says the system is broken and I will fix it, right? Now, you and I know that everything he's doing, or virtually everything he's doing, is making a bad situation worse. But what Democrats try to do is tinker around the edges. You know, if your income is $43,927, you will be eligible for something. It's enormously complicated. You have to fill out 18 pages, but we'll get you that. All right. What we need to say is the system, what I would call uber capitalism, is an incredibly broken system. Let's just go through it. Bear with me for one second, all right? Richest country in the history of the world. More income and wealth inequality than we have ever had. Richest people doing phenomenally well. 60% of Americans living paycheck to paycheck. Healthcare system broken. Educational system, childcare dysfunctional, widely expensive, workers underpaid. Kids can't afford to go to college. You know, we once used to have a higher percentage of college graduates than any other country on earth. We were the best educated country on earth. That ain't the case right now. Kids coming out deeply in debt, okay? Other countries say, we want a well-educated workforce. We will guarantee you quality higher education. Don't worry about the money. Our public school system in deep trouble. We are not attracting the best and the brightest teachers. Teachers are asked to deal with disasters in their classroom. Kids who are have troubles disrupting the class. Bottom line is, last international exams we saw, the United States of America was something like 37th place. Got it? In terms of math, science, writing, and so forth and so on. Housing, a disaster. Transportation, try getting on a plane and seeing if you're going to get any place on time. It ain't going to happen. So if you look at the food, you got the food industry and essentially, you know, giving our kids crap, which causes obesity, which causes diabetes and a number of other illnesses. So if you look at the basic necessities of life, health, education, nutrition, housing, we're not doing well. We are doing rather poorly. So we need a radical and fundamental transformation of American society, a government that works for everybody, not just Mr. Musk and his friends.
When you look at what has taken place over the past 11 months, I don't think we have seen a more destructive force in terms of just the apparatus of our government, whether it's like, you know, Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the NLRB, the IRS, the Department of Education. I mean, on and on and on. The institutions themselves, the flow of people through it, the institutional memory, all of this destroyed in a way that I feel like we've never experienced in modern times.
We have never experienced before. Sam, we are dealing, let's see who we are dealing with. We're dealing with the president who really does not believe in the Constitution. When he has a lavish dinner and wonderful events for MBS, the dictator of Saudi Arabia, that's not an accident. And then he disparages Europe. What is that about? This is his idea of what government should be about. MBS, as you know, in Saudi Arabia, is a $1 trillion family, the wealthiest family in the world. They imprison, torture their political opponents. They do whatever they want to do, building cities and so forth and so on. That is Trump's vision of what government should be about. So in the process, you're going to act illegally. And the other thing, and unconstitutionally, you're going to destroy every agency of government that works for working families. And the other thing you do, and this is really disgusting, it goes a step deeper than destroying this or that agency, whether it's the FDA or the Center for Disease Control. What demagogues always do is they say, you know what? Our country has a lot of problems. Everyone's saying, yeah, I've got a lot of problems. And you know who the cause of that problem is? It is in Europe. It is the Jews. It's the gypsies. It's this group. In the United States, it's blacks. It's gays. And now it is the undocumented people, or it is those people from Somalia. That is the problem that we are having. You get rid of those people, man, you're going to get a really wonderful country. That is what demagogues, and that is the disgusting aspect of demagoguery. Rather than saying, all right, look, we got problems. How do you deal with the housing crisis? How do you deal with the healthcare crisis? You know, I have my views, you may have your views, Trump may have his views, but we don't even deal with those things. What we do is blame powerless minorities, and you rally the American people around vitriol and hatred. Really, a president of the United States calling a country garbage? People of a country? Really? That's what we're trying to educate our kids to do? So it is a deep issue. And what is the antidote? The antidote to that, in my view, is the need to rally the American people around an understanding the system is broken. And here is how we fix it. And if we get divided up because you're gay and I'm straight, or you're from Somalia and I'm from New York or Vermont or wherever I'm from, they are going to win. So So the message is that you have a movement of people, and Mamdani, in a very effective way, did that in New York. Massive numbers of volunteers, black, white, Latino, gay, straight, the whole works. That's what we need to do. And you can't do that, though. You know, Democratic establishment, well, how did he do it? Well, you can only do it if you have an agenda that excites people, that moves people. And if the establishment doesn't, which it doesn't, you're not going to do that. So we are trying to build, we're supporting really great candidates in the Senate, in the House, who understand those realities.
Last question. You mentioned Mamdani. How important is it that he deliver on those explicit campaign promises that he made around affordability, around the buses, about, you know, general improvement in life in New York City? Like, how important is it to the movement that you're talking about?
Enormously important. I do not envy this 36-year-old guy. I really don't. I was just with him last week, and we spent a lot of time together. Running New York City, man. I mean, people talk about it, I think correctly, is the second most difficult job in the world, in the country. I mean, among many other things, he has a million kids in his school system. How's that? That's just an aside, on top of all the other problems that he faces. So the point is, what the establishment, what the Democratic establishment, what the oligarchs, what the Republicans want him to do is to fail. All right? Enormous pressure on this young man's shoulders. They want him to fail so they can go around saying, see, democratic socialism, he talked a good game, he wasn't able to do anything. Vote for the establishment. That's your only hope. Vote for the Cuomos of the world. So there is enormous pressure. Everybody in the world, I mean, you got the entire establishment going to be on him trying to see that he fails. But if he can deliver, if he can, and by the way, between you and me, don't tell anybody, his agenda is not terribly radical.
No.
Yes.
In a city where nobody can afford to live, to say that you stabilize rents, not exactly a radical idea. When everybody knows how important childcare is to a human being's development, making it universal, high quality, and free, not a radical idea. It exists in many other countries. Improving public transportation, not a radical idea. Making sure that kids in underserved areas can get decent quality food with government intervention, really not a radical idea. I will do everything I can, and I hope, you know, everybody in this country will, to try to make sure that he succeeds. And there's just a lot of responsibility on his shoulders.
I imagine those who stand against Mamdani are less concerned about his policies actually working and more concerned about the broader sense of, like, what is possible and what can be done if he succeeds.
What a disaster for the establishment. If he succeeds, if you create a democratic form of government with a small d, where large numbers of people involved, you improve the schools, you improve healthcare, you improve transportation, you improve getting nutrition out to kids, you stabilize the cost of housing and build affordable housing. What a disaster for the Trumps of the world and the Republican establishment and the Democratic establishment. And all of those folks are going to be working as hard as they can to make sure that he does not succeed. So your point is, for better or worse, Mamdani's success and failures will not only impact New York City. They will be felt, by the way, not only nationally, but I think internationally. The whole world was watching this campaign. So, again, I wish this young man all the very best, and we will do what we can to support him.
Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont, thank you so much for your time today. Really, really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, guys. Take care.
Thank you.
Okay, folks, that was Senator Bernie Sanders on this program. Just now, we recorded that interview yesterday. Just a reminder, it is your support that helps this show keep on keeping on. When you become a member of the Majority Report at jointhemajorityreport.com, jointhemajorityreport.com, you not only get the free show free of commercials, but you also get to IM us during the fun half. You get the fun half. But most importantly, you keep this show independent of any undue corporate influence. The only money that we take from corporations is the ones that we advertise, that we allow to sponsor the program. And we have no, I guess, big Seba Day has a lot of its talons in us. But aside from that, also Just Coffee, speaking of talons, this co-op in Madison, Wisconsin, who really takes care to treat their suppliers, farmers in Chiapas and in Africa, I think mostly West Africa, but I'm not sure. Maybe some Ethiopian too, though. So East Africa as well. Treat their farmers and their producers well with fair trade. They're a co-op, and right now, 30% off. You don't even need the coupon code majority. 30% off to try the variety of Just Coffee coffees. So you can go, and if you've never had the Majority Report blend, I would try that one. But I would also try maybe some of the others. I think Bike Fuel is still my favorite. Although I've got a couple. But try out a bunch of different blends or single origin, justcoffee.coop. And also, don't forget the AM Quickie. We have two great writers who every day compile the news from a decidedly a left perspective. Whitney writes for the American Prospect. Corey, a longtime writer in the left space. Both tremendous. And you can get that 3 days a week for free by going to amquickie.com. If you want 5 days, I think it's a couple of bucks, not even a couple of bucks a week. It's like $1.50 a week. Not even $1.50 a week. Less. $1.35 a week, maybe. So check that out, amquickie.com. Of course, we've got merch. If you want to give somebody a Christmas present, I think you can still make it right now at shop.majorityreportradio.com. And, of course, the Discord, majoritydiscord.com. Matt!
Yeah, two things to plug today. First, selfishly, my Instagram. I'm trying
It's the wrong season for that type of selfishness.
It's like the right season for that. I can think about what kind of presents I'm going to get. All that sort of stuff.
That's true, actually.
A gift basket my parents going to send me.
Do your parents send you gift baskets?
Yeah, send me like Munster cookies and fudge and all that stuff for Christmas. It's delicious. I put on like 5 pounds in like 2 days.
All right.
So yeah, my Instagram, because I'm trying to get off of Twitter because I basically just like provoke Nazis. And I don't know if it's, you know, I don't know how much I need to do that more than I already am. And also Jacobin Show, which I produce, David Griscom had Jasper Nathaniel on. Now, we had 16,000 views on the second show, and then we had Jasper on to talk about the West Bank, and YouTube absolutely buried it. We got 1,500. So go subscribe, because you probably didn't see this recommended to you in your algorithm, but go subscribe to Jacobin on YouTube, and make sure you get the Jacobin Show, which airs at 10 o'clock every Friday morning.
Something weird is going on with YouTube.
Yeah.
Like something weird is definitely going on the past month, because we have lost new viewers. We have we can tell, like, there's data that says new and casual and regular.
Yeah.
Not subscribers, but new, casual, regular. I think like the definition is like casual is like under 5 times viewed in a month. And then I think over 5 times or something like that is regular. And usually, and then new. And usually we're like one third, one third, one third in terms of makes up our whole audience. Our numbers are not down. It's just that
the recommendations?
I don't know what it is.
That usually is what it is. It's not serving up the recommendations.
Yeah, it's weird, but usually your numbers will drop overall if it's not serving up. But I have a feeling, I don't know, something's going on. They're always doing something over there. And, you know, people have also complained that in their year-round YouTube raps, which I'm not even familiar with, but I guess that's like the who you've been watching most, we don't show up in it, even for people who watch the show every day.
Yeah, people are suggesting that might be the unlisted fun half thing isn't counting toward that, which is plausible, I guess.
Who knows? I mean,
stupid look, AI, if that's what's happening.
We got to burn this whole thing down.
Let's go to Mr. Everybody. Brian Vokey on Instagram. And
yeah. Go to Brian and Matt on Instagram. Let me see what my Instagram is. I'm it's sam.cedar.
Yeah. You start getting busy on there.
I'm going to take off. I've done two posts.
And is this the one you want to be plugging?
I didn't know how to do that. No, that's my main channel.
And you've done two posts on it?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I think I did that by mistake. I think people sent it to me.
That's why I'm asking.
Well, I'm going to soon. Just listen, I will start posting stuff there if I get to, right now I have 5,400 followers. If I get to,
I got that much.
If I get to 10,000 followers, I'm going to do at least a post.
You'll do,
and then also a story.
If I those hit two 50, different things, 000, I will also do a post.
If there's story, or is it like a story?
Yeah, there's stories. There's
okay, Brian's going to show me how to do it.
Sam will
and,
do,
and we will actually, we will. That will be our first post.
Sam will do the
you teaching me how to do Instagram, and me being all a boomer about it. I'm not technically a boomer.
Sam will do the Tyla Chanel dance.
I don't know what that is. 6'7".
Oh, God. All right, fun half.
See you in a fun half. 3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow. What? What is that going on? It's nuts. Wait a second. Hold on for a second. The Majority Report. Emma, welcome to the program.
Fun
hat. Matt!
Boo. Fun hat.
What is up, everyone?
Fun hat.
Nomi Key.
You did it!
Fun hat.
Let's go, Brandon.
Fun hat.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women's...
Stop. Talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this 7-8?
Yes.
Hi, me? Is this?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
Oh, I'm going to go start off.
You libertarians.
They're so stupid, though.
Common sense says, of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him.
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say. 857-210-35-501. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion.
Sold.
It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this. Poop.
You can call it satire. Sam goes with satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled,
wow,
folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock. We're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you. Bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.
Also, go to the Majority Report Instagram, of course. Don't be ridiculous. That is majoritycourt.fm. Majoritycourt.fm.
Gino's doing great work over there.
Gino's killing it there.
How the fuck am I even supposed to sell this property?
By the way, I didn't hear when we played that yesterday. The first part of that rant about selling a property is he's alleging that he has tenants
who are getting harassed.
Who got beat up. He said, beating my tenants. And then his next thought is, how am I going to sell this?
Well,
I would say don't broadcast the assaults. First.
That would be the first thing.
And also there's ghosts.
But I mean, it seems to me that if you sold the property, then people would not harass those tenants anymore. Maybe you should have done that a long time ago for the sake of those.
Yeah, I think it's about you and not the property. If that's happening, which I...
Right, but yeah, if those people are beaten, not like... Telecom. No sympathy for them whatsoever.
Oh, whatever. They're just standing in the way of my real estate sales.
Oh, this is going to knock $10,000 off the price.
Imagine somebody breaking into your house and beating you because your landlord is a shit poster on YouTube.
Oh, my God.
How much did he buy the skate park for?
I don't know. He spent a lot. I think he spent just too much money. Donald Trump on his affordability tour, even though affordability is not an issue. Here he is. Did we clip him talking about the farmers? Because that might be worth clipping to follow this up. But here is John Berman on CNN interviewing Caleb Ragland. He is a farmer, and he is reacting to the bailout that the Trump administration is doing for farmers. It's really sort of like, I take a baseball bat, I smack Matt in the mouth with it, and then I go, here's a coupon to go see a dentist. Good.
Last time we've had you on, and we have had the chance to talk to you pretty regularly throughout this very difficult year, you told us that the government bailouts never make farms profitable. So while you're grateful for this, in terms of the long term, does this fix things?
Well, this is a Band-Aid on an open wound. And again, we're thankful that there's something that this will help keep some farms in business. But what we truly need are market-based solutions. Those are sustainable long-term. Here domestically, we have opportunities for the administration to finalize the renewable volume obligations for biofuels here before the end of the year, the 45Z tax credit. We have numerous opportunities to expand markets worldwide, and we truly need demand. Because without demand, we're not able to receive a price that is economically sustainable for our crop. And that's what American soybean farmers want, is opportunities to make a living, to make a profit from the market not being dependent on the next program to keep us from bleeding to death. But the situation's serious. I've been farming 21 years now full time, and this is by far the most serious economic situation that I've experienced and my family's experienced. And I think that's the same for many farmers across this country. We're looking at a 1980s type farm crisis if this trend continues, and we're hoping to turn the tide. We need opportunity. The American farmer is the best in the world. We simply need a level playing field, both for our cost of production and making sure that we don't have obstacles that are causing our exports to be hindered. Because we're great producers. We just need a level playing field and opportunity moving forward, and hope the administration can deliver that in the future.
I mean, I wonder what obstacles he's talking about. He probably doesn't want to get too specific on that. But, I mean, farmers are facing, on top of the tariffs, which are the main thing that's killing them right now, killing them because it ignited a trade war, where in particular soybean farmers just got destroyed. Because
the most populous country on Earth decided to stop buying entirely from the soybean.
And as we told you, I think it was yesterday or Monday, China's exports... China, there was, what, 30% less exports to the United States from China to the U.S., but China's overall exports are down 1%. So, in other words, the vast majority of that one-third that they stopped exporting to the United States was made up in other places. And so... we have very little leverage over China. We can say, we're not going to allow you into these markets. And they can say, whatever, dude.
The rest of the world's still interested.
And not only whatever, dude, but guess what? We're not going to buy you soybeans.
And, you know, you have countries in Europe that are not overjoyed at all of the products being sent to their place, but they're actually having trade talks with China now, and that the sort of things that could develop into agreements where there's knowledge sharing. So how do we build these electric car plants, the battery plants, whatever? That's knowledge that Europe will start getting, presumably, if those agreements bear out, and will be left out of. So, like, what does the future look like for the American America's place in the economy? Is it getting bigger or stronger, or is it getting weaker?
Here is Donald Trump speaking in Pennsylvania last night about how he just helped out our farmers because they're doing so well. You get it? If you're doing great, you're going to get more help. And that's why we got you the help, because you didn't need it.
I just helped our farmers out because they're starting to do really well. But in order to try and negotiate, some countries played a little cute, and we just gave them right out of a tariff money, cost us nothing, right out of the billion, hundreds of billions that we've taken in. We gave the farmers a little help, $12 billion, and they are so happy. And all they want is a level playing field. And now it's happening. And the tariffs are making them rich. It's going to be, you're going to see what happens over the next 2 years.
Oh, so is it 2 years now?
Our farmers out.
I thought it was, I thought a couple months ago it was next year.
Yeah, let Nick say a year.
Now it's 2 years. So just to be clear, it cost us nothing. Now it depends on who the us is here.
We could have used that money for something else.
Well, aside from the fact that we could have used that money for something else, it was a tax on the American public. So it cost us nothing.
Well, he doesn't pay taxes.
I don't. Well, I may have paid tariffs, except for I'd get everything duty-free now. Yeah. So obviously it cost something. It has tanked the economy in many respects. And we've given them a bailout. Incidentally, all of it are going to basically two companies, two major, major agribusiness companies who are my buddies. And we did it because they're doing so great. And now China was getting cute. I think when China does this type of thing, it's not cute is not the word I would describe. Cute, like sort of like, oh, look at a little puppy. Yeah. It's more like China threw us over their lap and spanked us. And so we just cost us nothing. $12 billion.
It's basically a mail-in rebate for $5.
And again, like,
we got you covered.
It'll wipe out smaller players and lead to more consolidation, this sort of tumult.
Definitely. Illuminati kids, do you think there's going to be any soybean farming as far as a market solution like that farmer was framing it? Seems like China might be done. I mean, that's the thing. Wait, like, what are the costs associated with, like, deciding, like, I'm not going to grow soybeans anymore? I'm going to grow a different crop. I guess you have to figure out a crop where your equipment is going to be suitable for the new crop that you're going. I mean,
this entire trade war, particularly with China, has been undertaken in the stupidest fashion that completely overrates our standing in the world. Like, it's like 1982 or something.
Yep. Well, the worst thing is that, like, you're also exposing all of these weaknesses, right? Like, it's quite possible that China, maybe 5 or 10 years from now, had the plan that we're going to stop buying soybeans from the United States. It's possible. Maybe we would have had an indication that the folks would have had time to shift. But now it's just force them to realize they don't need us. So. Huh? Boy, they didn't know what they were doing. All right, let's play one more clip from Donald Trump. Today, the Fed is likely to announce a rate cut. I don't know if they have already or not. Donald Trump is, I guess he's just about now. I guess Powell is right now doing his briefing. But the Fed is expected to cut rates because the employment numbers are so bad, even though inflation is supposedly a little higher than they want. Now, understand, we went through inflation in the wake of COVID, but that was probably one-third logistics, maybe a little bit more, maybe half logistics, one quarter folks were still flush because of support from the government, and one quarter greed because companies realized, like, oh, we have cover to raise our prices, so let's raise our prices. What we're dealing with now is an inflation that's driven in part by tariffs. We are simultaneously dealing with that kind of inflation, but also job loss and also the GDP probably stalling out. We've had manufacturing starts at a 9-month all-time streak of dropping. To the extent that we can know what's going on with the economy, it seems like it is slowing and that several states in the country at least are in a recession. But the dilemma here is that the Fed is worried about the inflation because it's not going down. Affordability is still a problem. I suspect this is a function of wealth disparity because you have the money concentrated in the hands of so few people, relatively speaking, that they're sort of immune to their spending is sort of immune from any type of increase in rates. They're going out and they're buying their houses in cash. You're not seeing, we've already seen the AI bubble, but what's driving the AI bubble? For a while, it was low interest rates and people just need to find some place to put their money. Wealthy people do. But so much of the AI is just being driven by these massive companies that have so much money and cash that they can afford to blow billions of dollars and not worry about it. So we're stuck here. But here is Donald Trump lamenting that Jerome Powell has not risen rates faster and more often, and apparently forgetting that Donald Trump was the guy that appointed Jerome Powell.
You have a lousy Fed chair. And by the way, it looks, you're going to have to check this, please. I just heard it could be that all four commissioners in the Fed signed by Biden, including too late. You know who too late is? Too late, Powell. Jerome too late. He's too late with his interest rates for a reason. He's a bad guy. He's not a smart guy, but he's a bad guy. Too late. Is he going to lower rates a little bit finally? Did you see where Jamie Dimon, respected guy, said, you got to get the rates down, you schmuck, you know? But I hear that the auto pen may have signed those commissions. If they signed those commissions, now maybe I'm wrong, but we're going to check. Have you checked that? Are you hearing it? Who signed it? Did he sign it or did the auto pen sign it? I'm hearing the auto.
This is the first opportunity I had to ask any of my staff this question. Hey, everybody in the crowd, you got your drink over there? All right. Hey, can anybody remember who nominated Jerome Powell? Do you got a, hey, you over there, oh, there it is. Yeah. Okay. Oh, I did. But you like the fact that I'm doing what is known as a form function joke, right? Because old Otto Penn had no idea what he was doing. And then I'd say, Otto Penn signed Jerome Powell, but it was me.
Yeah, this was me who said, today President Trump nominated Jerome Powell. Powell has demonstrated steady leadership, sound judgment, and policy expertise. Mr. Powell would bring the Federal Reserve a unique background of government service and business experience.
Bad guy. Bad guy,
but not a smart guy.
It's AI.
Guy.
You see something you don't like, you call it AI.
Bad guy.
Just like Ronald Reagan, he left tariffs. That was his favorite word.
Bad guy. There he is. And he's just been juiced, too, so you'd think he'd be on it a little bit more. What's the... Okay, yeah, we should do this.
Princess Leia.
It's the fun half. Oh, you know what? Let's take some phone calls. I'm going to do this right here, folks. I'm going to take a little phone callies. Been a while. And there we go. Yes, folks. 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920 is the number. I guarantee you will not be on hold for more than an hour. And I also guarantee I will not get to all of you. So, caveat emptor, caveat caller.
Sure.
All right. Folks can go Google that.
Yiddish?
Are you serious?
No. No, it's Latin. I'm just kidding.
All right, folks. Look, we mentioned yesterday that there is a crazy ongoing war on the right. And it's sort of like there's like almost three different major poles that are fighting, I think. I mean, it could be more than this. But you'll recall that Charlie Kirk, before his death, was threatening to invite Tucker Carlson to CPAC. Or not to, was it to CPAC or TPUSA's?
TPUSA's big shindig.
Whatever that was. And maybe even Candace Owens. And Kevin Roberts of Heritage was mad that people were pushing back on that. And so he came out and said, I am okay with Tucker Carlson and with Nick Fuentes. And then J.D. Vance was asked about Fuentes, and he was hesitant to attack Fuentes because he's nervous about Fuentes. And then Candace Owens starts to investigate the Charlie Kirk murder because apparently the actual killer of Charlie Kirk, either the FBI has screwed something up in a big way, or the killer is not the left-wing agitator they wanted him to be. And so they're not releasing any information 3 months later, which is weird. I mean, it's really weird. Mm-hmm. And this leaves this vacuum open for Candace Owens, who is, I don't know if she's a grifter or if she's crazy.
Because of synergy.
You know, who knows? I'm not going to cast aspersions on anybody. That's just not the way I operate. People know that about me. And
everybody says that.
Says that about me. But apparently Tim Pool is convinced that Candace Owens has been agitating things too much and she's going to cost the Republicans the midterm elections, and that she is responsible for people shooting at his compound, which is really fascinating because Tim Pool, I think specifically in the past, has said nothing he said that was cited by shooters and killers in the past counts. So it's impossible for that to be motivating, which is interesting. I just find it interesting. Anyways, Tim Pool, as we said yesterday, went off on Candace Owens and used a lot of vile language.
A vile C word is...
among others.
Among others, yeah.
And Candace Owens responded to Tim Pool.
Scared that she'll put you on her thumbnail and claim you benefited from Charlie Kirk's assassination, which she's doing to me right now.
Yeah, that was the...
I'm done with these people.
She has security just not on the level of you.
Oh, yeah, the one fat guy you mentioned with no wall and no barrier in a suburban neighborhood with neighbors shouldn't give two... No one's out for her. She's lying about
pause
all
it.
This.
Now, you know, me. I mean, I don't know if Candace Owens ever specifically said, you know, described Tim Pool's security. I don't know how he has so much security. He doesn't have a videotape of, how do you not have a video camera on that stuff?
Yeah.
He did say that he live streams his chicken coop. And if anybody has documented that, you can hear the shots.
Okay. But why wouldn't you?
Dealey Plaza.
I've been to his compound. It's a gated compound. I don't know why you wouldn't have video cameras up there, but whatever. But he seems to have just expressed like what all of Candace Owens. What's he going to do? Put a map out there for like her?
It's weird, yeah.
I mean, that seems weird to me.
And he goes. He emphasizes. He goes on.
But you know, Tim. It really does seem like Tim is having an emotional.
Oh yeah.
Breakdown, Matt.
Yeah, he is.
You know what I mean?
I do. Yeah.
You are having an emotional breakdown
right
now.
Yeah, it does feel like that. But keep going.
You told me you went to her house and she's got a 4-foot wall and one fat guy. And she doesn't give a shit about her security. Meanwhile, I get bullets fired at my property and I have to go live in the middle of nowhere. And I got strangers coming up to my house in Maryland, breaking in. I got people showing up and beating up the residents who are trying to live there. How the am I even supposed to sell this property?
So there's a lot to unpack there. First and foremost, what you are seeing right there is not a display of testosterone. Men that speak to women like this are not tough guys, okay? What you are seeing is actually a display of estrogen. Everything he is doing there is somebody who is not a man. He is not tough, and he would never dare to speak to a man like that, right? People that find that very easy. Secondly, Tim Pool doesn't even have the intellect to understand that we put him in the
hold
thumbnail.
Hold on for a second. Before we get to Candace Owens saying that Tim is stupid. I think it's, I have to say, I don't agree with Candace Owens on just about anything. And, but I do have to say that I thought Tim was, aside from him being misogynist in that, in that rant of his, because we didn't play the part where he called her a C word. But, you know, I've noticed this trend with Tim too. Tim does not act that way towards men. Tim did not call me what he called Emma after she left. He accused her of pedophilia. When I went to see Tim, he was, and there was plenty of times where he was like tough, you know, got, he never got as angry and as emotional and unbalanced as he did there. But Tim was
what is agreeable for much of it.
Well, I was going to say supplicant. That's like another he good was word, like yeah. supplicating a little bit. I mean, he was, there was a lot of like, he was timid around me.
Yeah.
And I don't think I'm a physically imposing person.
You were wearing a leather jacket.
I was not wearing a leather jacket. No, no, I was not.
You didn't strike a match off your beard?
I mean, Tim did say to me when I got up from his table, like, they're mad at me. And I was like, who, your staff? And he goes, no, my audience, because they think I agreed with you so much.
The
now,
chat was
that I
out.
Did find. I mean, I did find that to be interesting because he really did. He really backed down from everything that, except for the fact that he thought that, like, you know, rape wasn't real. What was it that he said about abortion? He
had there's obligations if you are raped before you can get an abortion.
Oh, right. You know what? Maybe we'll go. I'm going to go over. Maybe we'll put out a couple of clips of that because I never really got to it because I had to go for the election and my mother passed away that weekend. But I think there she's onto something here. I don't know if it's just estrogen or testosterone. I don't know. But I definitely think that Tim is being a little bit. It's weird because in that same rant, he complained about getting so many texts from right wing talkers who were afraid to go after Candace Owens and applauding him. And he got really mad, but there was only one name that he said,
mm-hmm.
and it was Megyn Kelly.
Ah.
I mean, it's like he's afraid to call out men who did that. I said it's like that. I don't know. Maybe tomorrow or today he will criticize
J.D. Vance or someone.
The right wingers who reached out to him who were male. And he will call them, you know, put a name to the coward label, but he only seems to do it with women. And I mean, how many right-wing women are there in that world anyways? But Candace Owens is about to make the argument that Tim is stupid. I want to see if this one resonates too.
Secondly, Tim Pool doesn't even have the intellect to understand that we put him in the thumbnail because he accused me in a full episode with Milo Yiannopoulos, which we showed and contextualized, of being someone who benefited from Charlie Kirk's assassination. So he thinks he's being accused. No, you accused me of that in like a multi, actually, I think it was 2-hour episode with Milo Yiannopoulos in which Milo defended me and explained that I am not to blame for the lame excuses that the feds have given us regarding Charlie Kirk's assassination, and that if we do need to have some spiritual searching in terms of what the Republican Party has become, that the time for that is now. Okay. So this little, and I really like, this is a, he's a small person for this, a very small person who's okay. also theatrical.
I'm going to disagree with Candace here. I'm going to, you know, she's saying that Tim is a small person. He's of dim intellect. He's theatrical. I think she's saying that he's sort of like putting on a show and he's not really, none of this is really true. He's being insincere. And I'm going to disagree with Candace Owens that I think the Republican Party needed to reflect spiritually a long time ago. That's the part I would disagree with in what she's been saying here. Let's continue this.
Smollett, who pretends every year like,
sorry, I need to get this dig about Tim doing a lot of Jussie Smollett content coming from somebody who probably also did a lot of that content.
A very small person who is also theatrical, Timothy Smollett, who pretends every year like people are trying to kill him. He's a chronic fence sitter, okay? Pretending like he is braving the wilderness for being what? The 110,000 person who's making a video about Candace Owens in the wake of Charlie Kirk's assassination. He thinks he's pioneering that. Are you out of your mind? It's only the safest thing you can do. What's next? Is he going to make a video and call Kanye West anti-Semitic? Like that's what he's pioneering right now. Oh my gosh, so original. Like, is he going to call Donald Trump evil in 2016? This is the storm that he's braving, is jumping on the side of what everyone else is doing. He is a fundamentally weak man for what he did there. He should apologize. He won't. I don't care what happens to his platform. He's now essentially trying out, because he's under financial pressure. He's trying out for a Zionist to pay him, and they will. Okay. They will cut him a check. And I hope it happens for you, Tim. I hope it makes you happy. But to do that to someone who has never done anything to you other than disagree with you about the Charlie Kirk narrative, I have not focused my content on you. And any time your name has come up, it has been because
you have. Okay, this is just getting into drama. I mean, I think she makes a lot of good points about Tim, but it is hard to see people fight like this.
When they're like throwing, like, what's so funny is, like, I do agree with Tim Pool in a limited sense that I think the way Candace Owens has turned the death of her friend into a true crime story where she keeps like promising evidence in the future is crazy. But none of these right wing guys can land a punch on her, because Tim literally says, like, you're disorganizing the Republicans for the midterms, as if that's the relevant, like,
well, that's the other thing. Exactly. The problem is that they are looking, it is literally like the Spider-Man meme. They are pointing at each other, and they are just looking back at themselves. The idea that Candace Owens is responsible for the Republicans polling being in the toilet, yes, is so either stupid or disingenuous that it's almost impossible to imagine. It's almost impossible to imagine. But Tim, like, will spin this yarn, which is no different than the yarn that Candace Owens is spinning. It's just on a different topic. And Tim, who is always, like, complaining about the drama, only engages in drama. I mean, if you go back and look at, like, most of his, it's always been, like, these sort of, like, weird TikToks as to which person threw the first punch. Was it the fascist burning a cross, or was it the anti-fascists? I mean, he is literally like sort of being forced to eat what he has been serving.
Search Civil War in his video titles.
It's insane. It's insane. He is being forced to eat what he has been serving for so long, and he doesn't like the taste of it.
I'd like this, introduce a new drop, late drop of the year, but
what you are seeing is actually a display of estrogen.
There you go. Calling from a 301 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Is this me?
It is you.
Wow. Great. How are you doing?
Fine. What's on your mind? Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Calling from the good old state of Maryland. Had a question for
your name is?
Oh, you can just call me Nemo. It's my nickname.
Nemo.
Yeah. Question and a mini rant. My question is, do you think the Democrats overall and their strategy, do you think they're being too nice? And by Democrats, I mean like AOC, Bernie, Zoran. I don't consider Hakeem a Democrat. I think he's a Republican, honestly.
Well, he's a Democrat, but but I get what you're saying. What do you mean by too nice?
Like, I feel like, especially the way AOC and Zoran, or they're using politics in a way to try and make deals with guys like Hakeem and what's the Senate Majority Leader's name? The guy I can't
Schumer?
Stand. Chuck Schumer. Yeah, that guy. I feel like they're trying to play politics, and I don't.
Well, let me ask you this.
I feel like you can't.
Let me ask you this. Why do you think Mamdani would be doing politics with Hakeem Jeffries?
I understand why he wants to get his agenda passed. I understand that. But I don't sincerely think you can trust someone like that. I feel like he'll still try to undermine his mission.
He might. And, he might. But how, I mean, I think it's quite clear to me that there was some type of deal that Mamdani struck with Jeffries, right?
Mm-hmm.
That when they met, Jeffries was like, don't come for me. And Mamdani was like, don't stop my agenda. And that was the deal. And I think you know it. I know it. I mean, he wasn't explicit when he came on the show about it, but it was quite clear. He said, like, the reason why we're not supporting a challenge of Jeffries is because my job is to get is to make sure that our mandate is fulfilled.
And I would just suggest that the DSA members that voted to prioritize that also know about the nature of Jeffries.
Just everybody knows that. And so, you know, like you can say, and I could say, dude, you have plenty of political capital to pull both off. But I don't know that I would believe that personally, but it's quite clear he doesn't believe that. And, you know, we can prefer, you know, we can still hate Jeffries. And frankly, you know, like we can still sort of like have designs on his seat in 2 years. But I think Mamdani feels, this is my guess, and I think it's, you know, fairly obvious, that he doesn't want the most powerful congressional member in New York State, and probably the one of the most powerful congressional members in the country, because he's the, you know, leader of the Democrats, to manipulate things in such a way that it's harder for him to get stuff. So in other words, Jeffries, if he becomes speaker, and even in minority, as the minority leader, he has the ability to direct monies to different congressional people's districts. That money goes down to state assembly members. Those people are the ones who are going to be voting or pressuring Hochul or voting for or against any packages to raise taxes in New York City. That's just the way it works. Or they can thwart a lot of this stuff. And so this is the calculation he's made. It's not, you know, like when you say it's politics, this is like, yes, it is politics. It's exactly the way that you get things done when you talk about providing material benefits for people. And here's the interesting thing about this is that people criticize Mamdani, but if this was AOC, they'd all be saying he's careerist, right? Like when and it's obviously different when you're an executive versus a lawmaker, the topography of the world is different. But this is probably the biggest political job that he can ever have, right? Like he can't run for president. Mm-hmm. He could be governor of New York, I guess, one day, but it's really, you know, like being mayor of New York City is Sanders said in this interview we did, second hardest job probably in the country. And he's certainly like, you know, it would probably be a lateral move if he's governor, I guess. I mean, and so he's doing this because he wants to deliver. He wants to deliver for New York City citizens, and he wants to deliver for the movement. And we can, you know, you could second guess his judgment that it would be better for the movement if he risked succeeding as mayor to attempt to get Hakeem Jeffries replaced by some backbencher in Congress and have Catherine Clark as the Speaker of the House. But I don't know. That doesn't sound like a smart thing. If your goal is to both help materially New York City citizens and to help the movement nationally, I mean, as Bernie said in the interview we just did with him 10 minutes ago, not only is it going to resonate nationally, but it's going to resonate internationally. And it's all about whether he can deliver, you know, universal child care, faster buses, raise those corporate taxes, you know, 4 grocery stores. I mean, like Bernie said, it's not a radical agenda, but it must, he must succeed. He must succeed.
And like, and I guess my biggest point is like, I worry because like the Democrats have been so bad at strategy for so long. I just hope what they're trying to do here works out. Like, I feel like what we need is like, because they always call like voices like AOC and Zora on the far left, but I feel like they're like barely far left. I feel like you could have
right. No, I agree. I agree.
To the left, because like,
look at what's happening with the affordability thing. Just Mamdani won on affordability, and Trump is out there trying to run on affordability. All the Democrats are running on affordability. Now, the word is like very vague, and it can mean different things to different people. But this is the way that politics works. This is the way that society works. It works with television shows, for God's sakes. Mm-hmm. Oh, we have four hipsters in a room. Well, everybody's going to do four hipsters in a room.
And I do think there is a moment that needs to come where you need to go for the juggler. I think Zohran knows how to do those moments. The debate moment where he said, "I'm not you, Andrew. I didn't sue women for their gynecological records." That's a type of edge that I frankly wish I have seen from Bernie in some of the primaries. And I want to see from folks, but I do think you need to pick your spots about that. And look at like how Plattner's running up in, Maine. Sorry, Brian. he's going at Collins, and he's not going at, and then the Republicans, he's not going at his Democratic primary voter. I think that's smart because I think like these sorts of progressive type left, and again, like it's not like they're not communists, but like left in terms of our political system, they have a chance to take over these voters in a way that they haven't before. Yeah. Like the way that people turn out to the oligarchy thing, again, like I do think it needs to turn towards a more DSA socialist type of organizing ground up thing that got Zohran involved. But I think they're there for the take, and I think that's the calculation people like AOC and Bernie are making right now.
Appreciate the call.
And like, thanks.
Cole from Michigan. Was the DSA vote about not primarying Jeffries or just not supporting Kiyase? Well, it was about the DSA not getting involved in primarying Jeffries.
I don't think it was a reflection on
Brooklyn Progressive. If you're passionate about supporting Kiyase, you can still volunteer. DSA is not the only path to victory. There are many progressive clubs and orgs that do this work and may be controversial to say here, but some are better at local organizing than the DSA. Yes, I just don't think that anybody's going to challenge without like any of that muscle behind them.
Yeah, prove it. I would love to see another left org come and topple Hakeem Jeffries. And I think with them doing that, while Mamdani saying, "Actually, I'm focused on New York. Don't make every one of my interviews about that," is actually dialectically probably a good stage to get to.
Oh, I got no problem. We got somebody who's going to, challenge Jeffries in a meaningful way, because I don't want to, tell people to donate to a candidacy that is sure not to win.
I'm serious.
But if there's a serious challenge out there, I mean, you can be sure we're all in for it. I mean, the whole point is, I don't think that Mamdani said, "I'm in charge of everybody who might."
I'm DSA director now.
Dizzle McFizzle, Jeffries is going to cook Mamdani anyway. Jeffries is a snake and he'll betray Mamdani regardless. So Mamdani should have supported a primary against him. But what do I know? I'm just a dues paying member of DSA in Wisconsin, so it doesn't matter. Well, first off, that is quite a bet. Like, Jeffries, would Jeffries like to be an obstacle to Mamdani? I would bet yes. Will he be able to do it in a way that he feels like, because it's not like this guy's not a senator. He's not in office for 6 years. There's going to be another primary in 2 years. It behooves Jeffries to inhibit Mamdani's power. It makes it much harder for him to do so in this environment. That's all it is. There's no guarantees here, but it's just a question of like, it's a bet. It's probability.
You can build power and move them out later. Like it's like this idea you have to open up every front of a war at the earliest given moment. Like, I'm glad you're in a DSA. New York DSA didn't vote that way. Nurse the grievance, I guess.
Let's go to a 606 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Hey, folks, can you hear me? This is Noah from Lexington, Kentucky.
Noah from Lexington, Kentucky. What's on your mind?
Well, so I just wanted to call in. I'm hearing a lot of DSA talk. I'm the co-chair of the new Bluegrass DSA that's out of Central Kentucky.
Nice.
And it's, yeah, it's been kind of a dark time in general. Thank you very much. I feel so honored. But yeah, it's been a very dark time in general, but we're coming up on our one-year anniversary, and we just crossed 200 dues-paying members in Central Kentucky. Yeah, it's been fantastic. I'm originally from Eastern Kentucky, from Jackson, where J.D. Vance pretends like he's from. And so, you know, I think there's kind of a stereotype about what organizing can look like in a place like Kentucky, and it's just been fantastic for us. I mean, I'm going to brag on my comrades here a little bit. So, yeah, just crossed 200 dues-paying members. Most of our general meetings are getting 50 to 70 people, and we're running our first electoral candidate. So that'll be Herbert Lynn for at-large city council in Lexington. Yeah, raised a couple $1,000s or $5,000 in food and money during the SNAP cuts for different food banks around town. And then we're doing a big push with local unions like SBWU and AFT. And fighting the expansion of these AI flock cameras in our town. So there's my my spiel. But yeah, it has been fantastic. It's one of the things I'm most proud to be a part of in my entire life.
Same okay, way. Well, we've got your Instagram up right now. It's Bluegrass DSA.
You got it.
And just hit the link tree too. There. Let's see what you got on your link tree. The December library run, Bluegrass DSA t-shirt sign up. Is there a donation page for that candidate you're running?
So we are getting that set up literally this week. So yeah, follow us on Instagram, and we will have all that up. Our website is also, dsabluegrass.org that has all of our events. So if you happen to be local to the area, please come out. They're all open to the public and we'll have everything up there.
And so how far away do you like, you got 200 dues paying members. How far away, what's the furthest sort of geographical distance that people are going for a Lexington chapter?
Yeah, so the chapter is Bluegrass, so it covers Frankfort, which is the capital of Kentucky, as well as Lexington and kind of all the towns in between. But we have comrades because, much to my chagrin, there's not an Eastern Kentucky DSA yet. We're actually helping one start up right now. But we have comrades that are coming all the way out from Richmond, Kentucky. And then there's obviously a very big active chapter in Louisville. So they handle a lot of the area there. And then we have an Owensboro chapter that's opening up. So we're trying to stay very involved with getting more chapters opened up and getting people fighting back in Kentucky.
Yeah, Colin, what's the vibe like? I talked with Mo Hartzell out in Missouri, also the Afton Bend race, both of which I would describe as sort of like a socialist-friendly progressives. You know, what is the general vibe like? You talk about the dark times, but it does seem like there's a little bit of momentum growing.
Absolutely. I mean, in a place like Lexington, right, like this is a rich, white, liberal city, right? And so I think a lot of people would expect that to have there are benefits and there are big cons, right? So we've been very lucky to have people that, you know, have been able to come into the chapter and it's been fantastic. But we also do get pushback from some of the what I would call more liberalizing forces in the town, some of the nonprofits. We're trying to work with as many people as we can to make Central Kentucky a better place to live for people in the working class. So there's kind of that push and pull between what I would say people that are very focused on the way that their politics look versus actual economic changes that will, you know, help everyday people.
Appreciate the call. Good luck. We'll put a link to we'll put a link to the website. People can find your Instagram after that.
I truly appreciate it. Thank you guys so much. Left is best.
Thanks for the call.
Alrighty.
Bye. Good stuff. Lavender allergy. I think the WFP also deserves credit for organizing the primary field to cross endorsement against Cuomo so effectively. Yeah, I think so. The WFP has endorsed Brad Lander in his race against
Dan Goldman.
I wanted to read this.
Dump Dan.
I thought this was really impressive. Yulin Nu, she came in second to Goldman in 2022. There was a crowded race. And even then, she came in. It wasn't very far. Like less than 2 points, I think it was. And she put this out. Because a lot of people wanted her to run again this time. Against Dan Goldman. I've got it here. 3 years ago, and maybe she put this on her Twitter, I think. 3 years ago, our rising progressive movement came within 1.6% of victory in New York's 10th. We built a powerful grassroots movement that energized thousands of voters who are hungry for real progressive change on housing, healthcare, climate justice, and economic equality. As we saw from the amazing results of this year's mayoral election, we didn't fall short because our message was wrong or weak. We fell short because progressive candidates split the vote and our opposition remained unified. I know firsthand the cost of a fractured progressive field. I've lived it, and I will not let it happen again. That's why today I am making the difficult decision to step aside so we on the left can consolidate behind a unified progressive candidacy. While I would be well positioned to win in a head-to-head race against the incumbent, the division of having multiple candidates on the left only helps the opponents of change. We can't afford that outcome. This is a gut-wrenching and bittersweet decision for me. As a disabled, queer, Asian American woman, my stepping aside likely means we won't see this intersectional representation in this seat for a long time. That hurts. For the AAPI community that has fought so hard for a seat at the table, for the disability community that rarely sees ourselves in Congress, for LGBTQ voters who deserve leaders who understand our lived experiences, for women of color who have been told to wait our turn again and again, this is a sacrifice I don't make lightly. But the people of New York 10, all of us, are struggling with skyrocketing rents, inadequate health care, and a climate crisis that threatens our future. We don't need another crowded primary where progressives tear each other apart. Our neighbors need us to be disciplined, strategic, and unified in delivering real change. They need us to fight for them, not amongst ourselves. This is such an impressive statement and action by somebody who, by all rights, had the pole position, as it were, in running against Goldman.
I feel like I've been like hinting at wanting her to run since for the last like 2 years.
Yes. And, you know, Brad Lander, in his cross promotion and his campaigning for Mamdani, you know, it's hard to sort of assess these things, but certainly, sealed the deal for Mamdani, probably made it completely irrelevant as to what Curtis Sliwa was going to do. And was going to get the support from Mamdani. So, you know, like both to like Kiyase and to Yulin Nu, who stepped aside. I mean, this is, and Alves, right? She also is not going to run.
Aviles
is going to clear the field. There's a very, very good chance that Brad Lander is going to take out Dan Goldman, and yeah. It's going to be a big upgrade for progressives. He's going to go in, and you know he's going to be a top 25 progressive in the House.
I mean, the Eric Adams race was catastrophic, and this is really just literally the left getting organized.
Yeah.
And that stuff can't happen again. And my preference is always, you know, more for the socialist or DSA people to get the better of these sorts of things. But the more important thing is discipline and focus.
You know, and I think she... No, I mean, I agree with you, but I think like, you know, in terms of like the votes, the meaningful votes that are going to come up, materially speaking, it's not going to be a huge difference. It would have meant more in terms of like she says, intersectionality. It would have meant more, I think, in having a voice that is might be more aggressively left. But materially speaking, in the in the near and midterm,
they're very close, Lander and Uline, I think, you know,
in terms of the votes that they're going to have the opportunity to vote for. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like, I mean, Lander was DSA previously.
Devoid reality. Speaking of Plattner, have you guys folks heard anything about a Plattner-like candidate thinking about New Hampshire since Sununu said he's running for Shaheen's seat? Shaheen has endorsed Chris Pappas, so he's out for me. I'm newish to the Lebanon-Hanover area, which seems Dartmouth liberal, not my cup of tea. This seems to be the best we can do in New Hampshire since the libertarian influx. I miss Oregon OR in this arena. I'm not sure, but... I haven't heard of anybody really coming. We had a name or two, but I don't know if they've quite popped, but we're going to look into it more, on the other side of the holidays. But, do we have that, Plattner, that audio that we played? Can we find that? The Plattner audio? When he was asked a question by a woman, this was a couple of weeks ago. See if you can find that. I'm going to take a phone call, and then I want to play that. Just remind me. Calling from a 308 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Hey, it is Kowalski from Nebraska. Am I coming in all right?
Kowalski from Nebraska. It sounds like you're out on a machine.
Yes, I am. I'll shut it off and deal with the wind and the cold. Have you ever been loved by a politician, Sam?
I mean, I would imagine from afar, but not...
Well, do you have information?
You see, Sam, there is a man in D.C., that says he loves me, my neighbors, and my entire class of people known as farmers. Some might say, people are saying that these days.
Okay.
Well, I'm sure you've heard about the big, beautiful bailout.
Oh, yes. No, we played Donald Trump talking about how he loves the farmers. He's going to give you all $11 billion because you're doing so well.
Yes. I'm just pointing out that I feel loved, seen. I mean, like, when was the last time the Democrats made you feel loved and seen?
The last time, never? I don't know. I guess.
Huh.
What are you saying?
Well, trying to play into some stereotypes, but to be honest with you, the hair on the back of my neck is starting to stand up, and I feel like I'm going to catch fire if I continue this little bit. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the way this bailout, so to speak, is going to functionally play out. And basically, it's a wealth transfer from all of you lovely consumers out there getting hit with essentially a federal sales tax.
Yep.
And it's going to go straight to agricultural supply companies because farmers are, well, pretty leveraged right now, especially in a year like this where soybean farmers were losing in some parts of the country, like Arkansas is probably one of the more harder places hit, $150-ish per acre. So, like, if you're a 2,000 acre farmer down there, you've lost about $500,000, something like that. The numbers could be off slightly, but like you lost a lot of money. So in order to handle that, you basically put a lot of your inputs on credit, whether that's like your equipment, your seed payments, or like your fertilizer. So as soon as the Farm Service Agency, which is a office within the USDA gets these checks to send out to farmers, they're going to have a little lien on the bottoms of most, and it's going to say that, like, I don't know, say Pioneer, for instance, if you finance seed through them, Pioneer will have to sign off on that check, and to sign off on that, it might be in your agreement that you just have to immediately send the money over to them. So this will, like, harm your ability to do, like, finances as you might wish to do. So, yeah, but basically this is just going to functionally keep farmers below break even, because we're all going to be cutting into our equity to pay for this. But it should allow enough cash flow to the big monopolies to keep them happy, because they're the ones with actual political power.
Right. Yeah, that was sort of our guess, that the big ag was going to do much better in this situation than farmers like yourself.
Surprise, surprise.
Yeah, so the love is not quite what you would think it would be. I mean, this is like, what's Trump's second daughter's name? It's that kind of love.
Tiffany. You feel like Tiffany in this situation.
Yes, yes. All farmers should feel like Tiffany right now. So, yeah, that's pretty bad. And also, I have put out a YouTube channel that I am starting to put more videos on. And a comment that I've been seeing a lot, which I just feel like broadcasting here. A lot of people, I'm sure, are upset with the way the majority of farmers voted. Totally get that. I understand that. However, I do just want to play devil's advocate here for a sec. We still don't want these farmers to go bankrupt or fail, because one thing we saw during the farm crisis of the 1980s is when you see large-scale farm foreclosures or bankruptcies, this drastically reduces the amount of taxes that these entities pay into their local counties, and property taxes in rural areas make up typically half of the county budget. So you're talking a massive defunding of schools and road construction, which then hurts the those employers, which then goes and hurts the service economy. This usually then puts more pressure on the state budget, as the states are trying to reallocate resources from the larger cities that are going to be less impacted to the smaller communities to try to keep them afloat. It's just a massive disruption that most places will not be able to handle. This will cause more rural flight. So, yeah, like, I get why people would be upset with farmers, but at the same time, if you don't keep this money flowing, a lot of people who did not support this, who did not vote for this, will suffer just as much. Yeah, just.
I mean, also, what is the point of anybody supporting one candidate over another? It is ostensibly, in my opinion, it should be, so that everyone's lives are improved in some fashion, or at least the body politic is improved. And it's not like farmers are high on the hog, as, no pun intended. People should not be cheering for other people to go bankrupt. I mean, I will say that I think there are some at the top of our income spectrum that I think would be fine for them to lose a significant chunk of money. In fact, I would make that programmatic. But, yeah, I don't think there's any value politically, and I just don't think it makes any sense to take joy in farmers getting screwed by Trump, even if they voted for him. People, you know, complaining about the bailout on some level, you know, in a generic sense, I think complaining about the bailout makes sense, because it's all, like you say, it's coming at the expense of everybody paying taxes on these products. It was complete waste of an exercise, and it's not going to make farmers whole. And people still paid on the other side, and it hurt the economy. So the whole thing is just a crap show. But Kowalski, exactly. I hope it helps you in some way.
We actually did okay this year, because we have a lot of off-the-farm income that helps keep us afloat. It it requires a ton of hours, but we're in a very different position than most other farms. So, I do just want to say tomorrow I plan on dropping a video on my channel, Prairie Fire Neb. Go like, subscribe, because apparently I need to be a content creator. And I'm going to talk about why farmers voted the way they did. And, I'm hoping to finally put that one to rest and fix all of this. So this should all be fixed by tomorrow afternoon. So don't worry.
All right. What's the YouTube channel again?
Prairie Fire NEB. NEB is for Nebraska.
Charge.
Kowalski, have you ever looked at a map of Lincoln and said this is the way we're going to approach in our combine harvesters when we're going to occupy the city?
Even if we occupied Lincoln, I don't know if there's anything we could do on a state level. I functionally don't think our political leaders have any plan. That's been one of the saddest things I've noticed when I've been getting really into understanding narratives and whatnot and what people believe. And frankly, I don't think a lot of politicians around here believe in anything. And when you don't believe in anything, you're just dealing with nihilism. I think you could have every farmer march on Lincoln and they just would not care at all.
Huh. Appreciate the call.
It's bad.
Stay warm.
Call it a good one.
All right, stay warm. Felonious Monk, may I have a shout out today? I turned 60 today. I started listening to the show in the mid-aughts. That was basically when it started. Upon reflection, I have fully realized how impossible it is for us to change, or possibly to stage just keeps moving. The whole of my life I have fought the army, addiction, and existence in prison. But when my self-pity settled, I focused on those I could help even when I couldn't help myself. The whole of my life I fought. Now it is for the prisoner class, my union soul, and the tens of thousands who, like me, know what the P means in PTSD. Today is my birthday. I hope I've done enough. Well, Felonious Monk, this is for you. Appreciate you and hanging in there. Future reactionary, Sam. You well see dereliction of duty when you lie about being in the bag for big co-op. South Wedge Lefty. Hey, RMR crew. Went to the merch store to order whistles to hand out at family Christmas. Sold out, which is a good problem to have. Any idea when you get more in? Side note, traded out HBO Max subscription for one to the show. Well, thank you for that. We should have them in, I think, within the next couple of days. The new whistles. They sold out fast. All right, do we have that Grand Platner? Okay, I just want to play a little bit of this audio. This was from about a month ago, I think. Grand Platner was asked a question by a woman at one of the rallies.
It was a town hall in Bucksport, Maine, and it was November 15th.
Okay, so it was about a month ago, and town hall in Maine, and it was about referencing, stuff that was in his Reddit material. And so just play just to refresh people's minds just a little bit of this question.
The day that the Reddit post dropped, my heart sank. Particularly for one reason. Your comments on sexual assault victims cut deep. I am a survivor. My story is remarkably similar to the one that you outlined in that comment. I never shared my story. I never reported it. And I didn't because I knew I would be defending myself against that mentality. For more than 20 years, I have never spoken of it. Until today. I have consumed every interview you have done since. To the point where it's pretty creepy, honestly. I but I realize that what I am seeking is a a sign of true growth and understanding of how harmful that mentality has been, of an expression of true remorse for ever thinking that it would ever be anybody's fault that someone else violated them so egregiously. So I'm asking right now, can you look me in the face as a survivor and offer me more than just shallow words?
I am sorry. I am sorry because I certainly, at earlier points in my life, held opinions that I do not hold now. When I made that comment 13 years ago, I had come out of the infantry, and I had a, frankly, myopic worldview on this issue.
Okay, and he went on, and we played that audio. I guess we played it about 2 weeks ago. And shortly after that, we got an email. I've been meaning to read this for a week or two. I'm not going to give her name. I imagine people up in Maine know, you know, who she is. I don't know if they've written stories about it, but I suspect, but I'm not going to. 4 days ago, the crew shared the audio recording of a woman confronting Graham at a town hall. Hi, it's me. I'm the woman. The audio doesn't tell the whole story. It doesn't share what happened after the conclusion of the town hall. It doesn't share the numerous people that formed a line to thank me for doing the hard but necessary thing and compliment my bravery, which is wild to me. I didn't have a plan to share my darkest secret with a room full of a few hundred strangers. I had forgotten they were even present. The audio doesn't share that Graham and I spoke privately after the town hall. While I won't share the exact details of that conversation, I do feel that I am finally appropriately processing the assault. The campaign has contacted me since to check in on how I'm doing and offer any support they can provide, and made it clear that they see this as my story, that they want to handle it with absolute sensitivity and respect. It's fair to say that I no longer have any doubts on Graham's genuineness, and if I could share what I have experienced with anyone questioning his authenticity, I feel their doubts would ease as well. I feel safe with Graham both as a person and to be the next elected official to represent me in the state of Maine. Being human is hard, and so is giving grace. Take care. We had one other exchange, but that was basically the gist of her feelings. And, you know, I think, largely this is, almost exclusively a Maine thing at this point. I think we may have him back on, either during the primary in the coming months or after. But there was a poll that was put out. Granted, it was commissioned by the PCCC, but I haven't heard anybody push back on it, certainly anecdotally. I know a couple of reporters now up in Maine, and it sounds like his momentum has just continued. And it's going around. There was an interesting piece in the New Yorker, or was it Politico, that I think did a profile on him. And it sounded like part of, you know, like the writer was like, there could be more to come. I don't know if there is or not. But, you know, it's quite clear that this is not somebody that I would have voted for in 2012. I can't vote in Maine, but to the extent that we think that it's possible for anybody to grow or change at all or to learn from their experiences, you know, you can never know what's actually in somebody's heart or mind, but this is... in my mind, I mean, pretty impressive.
By the way, that poll is 58% to 38% Blattner over
Yeah.
Janet Mills.
LaCasa worries, Sam, you can't seriously be promoting a guy who accidentally got a Nazi tattoo. Even if it was an accident, he should not be in office. It really shows the deep lows of our electoral process that leftists are still seriously supporting this guy.
I think what kind of leftist are you?
Well, I think the point is there are people who I think
lib
don't want. I think there is like two types of people who are still sort of like upset about this. One, who are not interested in the electoral process whatsoever, which, you know, look, I've had debates like about it. People on this. But again, yes, if you are, then what are you involving yourself in this for? Do I believe the story about the tattoo? I've been pretty clear on this. I absolutely 100% believe that he had no clue as to what that tattoo was.
Yeah.
I definitely don't think he had any idea of what it was when he, when we know about it because he danced shirtless at his brother and sister-in-law's wedding. She is Jewish, and I imagine half the people there were Jewish too. So I don't like.
100% believe the story.
Brass steel, brass balls. If he's doing that, and he knows, like, this is a Nazi tattoo. Is it possible that he found out later? Sometime between then and now, I would imagine. But it is so weird for me that a tattoo. A tattoo would be evidence.
A symbol.
It would be evidence. It would be evidence that this guy may be a Nazi.
Yeah, but not perfect evidence because I've seen so many vets say, actually, I got a pretty dumb tattoo as well.
Well, the point is you got to look at the totality of the evidence. And like, if it is, if you get this tattoo and there's nothing that could ever change that, then I guess I could understand that.
Yeah.
But I mean, the idea that I could get a hammer and sickle tattoo and then the communist community would accept that I'm communist.
Right.
Well, okay. I know I'm, you know, I lib out or I sock dem out or whatever it is.
I think the people who had questions about you would still have questions.
I suspect that people would say, you're not a communist because you have a communist tattoo. I just don't think it would work that way.
There's a, you know, I'm maybe not the great, best person to quote here, but Christopher Hitchens had a good quote in his book, Letters to a Young Contrarian, where he said there's like a split between the literal and the ironic mind. And ironic meaning you're capable of entertaining that things might have more than one meaning.
Yes.
And there are certain people who just can't. And this tattoo thing has been all of that like, oh, well, he must be a secret Nazi. He's not. I think that... I definitely believe him about the tattoo. I think anyone who thinks that he's a secret Nazi about this, like, you build your case.
Yeah. I mean, I've watched a lot of movies with Nazis in it, and I never saw that thing on their hat. I had no idea myself. I am not a secret Nazi.
Well, polymarket.
Now, I will say this. The idea of getting a tattoo terrifies me. The idea that I would have allow for a needle to pierce my skin without it having like a discernible, like I need to get it, like the shingles vaccine, the flu, this and that. But like the idea of like, you know, a needle for like tattoo or for drugs, like I could never do that. I could never associate a needle with something that like I'm going to be happy about.
There's a question with in the chat. Where is his buddies with the matching tattoos? They've corroborated his story. And actually, that would be a huge liability if they didn't. That's further evidence that he is, in fact, telling the truth.
My daughter has tattoos.
I almost got a line from a Martin Amis novel on my arm, and I'm very glad I didn't. You know,
that being said, Money is a great book.
Money is a great book, and it was for money, actually.
Well, Cesar says, never say never, Sam. And fair. Let me just put it this way. It's extremely hard for me to imagine at this point, 59 years into my life. But yes, I've had similar dispositions towards other things.
This is anecdotal, though, but just judging by certain members of my family who are still in Maine, if you wanted to run as just an outright Nazi, you could probably get some momentum.
Well, that's the other thing. Like, he's really gone to great lengths to... I mean, do you think Fetterman planned what he did? I don't.
No. I mean, I think Fetterman always sort of felt that way about Israel, that it was flagged by people like Ben Burgess in the primary for him. And whether he...
I don't think people were sensitive to it, frankly, at that time.
Right. But and you know, it wasn't, unfortunately, as pertinent. I think like Fetterman stuff on maybe the economy and like giving Republicans talking points on Obamacare. I think that is like a problem with his degeneration.
Yeah. All right. One final call and that's it. Last caller of the day, calling from a 208 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Hi, is this me?
Yes, it is you.
Oh, cool. This is Steve calling from Phoenix, Arizona with a Coeur d'Alene, Idaho area code.
Okay.
Hopefully this isn't too off topic, but I'm kind of close to the semiconductor industry. And with all of like the CHIPS Act and all of the TSMC and Intel in Phoenix and AI and everything else, I'm just dreaming about potential unionization in the industry and just don't really know how to go about it, because I just kind of feel like if I ever brought it up, I would just immediately get canned, whether that's kosher or not.
Well, you don't bring it up with management first. The way,
no.
Based upon like, you know, and we've had a lot of, I wonder what the tag would be. That's we need a tag for this. But we've had, if you go back and just search like Wednesdays, particularly over the past like 2 years, we've had a lot of people on who have started unions. The Starbucks union drive. We've had, I think, both the people who started that drive. Trader Joe's. A lot of people, and the way that these things start is by going to your friends who you think might be amenable first and talking to them. Don't talk to people who you don't think would be amenable. Only talk to people you trust. But then you can also reach out to what is the name of that? Matt, do you remember the name of that site that provides organizing help? And advice.
Is it the Emergency Workplace Organizing Committee?
Yes. The Emergency Workplace Organizing Committee, they will give you sort of best practices.
Okay.
And that also, you could do worse by reading Jane McAlevey's books.
But yeah, EWOC, Emergency Workplace Organizing Committee.org or workerorganizing.org.
And also go into check out the Discord at majoritydiscord.com, and you will find people there who will provide resources for you.
All right. Cool. Yeah. I was also hoping maybe just mentioning it on here, maybe that plants the seeds a little bit for some people who might be listening in the industry.
Well, I mean, if people are interested, go to the Discord, and that's a great place to connect.
Right. You
can find on YouTube, we have a labor union playlist, and there'll be a lot of people who basically just started their organizing. And I always ask them, like, what's the first couple of things you do?
Mm-hmm. All righty. Well, thank you very much.
All
love
right.
The show.
Appreciate the call. Good luck. Keep us updated.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Will do.
Breaking news. There's two things. One, Fed cuts rates by 0.25%, and U.S. military seizes a Venezuelan oil tanker off the coast. So here we go. That's reported by CNBC as of 45 minutes ago. Ah, fuck. Well, anti-war.
Yeah, I don't want to let the neocons get in charge, right, Mike Cernovich?
You got to start them so you can end them.
That's right. Luke Form, can we do that? Yeah. All right, a couple IMs and we'll get out of here. Definitely not Cameron. Is Jeffries just a complete villain to the left, or is he a spineless politician who bends where the winds are blowing? I think it's probably the latter.
I think a lot of the latter. I mean, his stuff, particularly on just Israel, you look at his brother, who is, I believe, like an adjunct professor somewhere, has like the right position on that. Hakeem Jeffries, earlier in his career, had to answer for something his uncle said, which was like on the sort of black Israelite anti-Semitism type of thing. And Hakeem Jeffries has always been very careful not to awaken that as a hit against him. And, you know, that's pretty central to his entire run.
I mean, this is a guy who was supposedly afraid that he was going to lose the midterms because of Mamdani. And if anything, it's completely flipped the narrative. Charlie Kirk's ghost. Bernie, it's not genocide Sanders. Hard pass. Okay. I suppose you could support who else is in Vermont.
No idea.
Peter Welch. People's Eyebrow. Bernie, the original goat. Josh from law school. Also worked for a federal judge on work study this fall. Some of it digging through habeas petitions. Those filings are dark. First off, Bernie's not running again. So I think, like, you know, when you got a politician like that, I think what you do is you, like, take the good. Bernie could come out tomorrow and call for the complete decolonization of Israel. Like, the complete decolonization. And it would have absolutely no impact on the decolonization of Israel, but it probably would inhibit his ability to do other things. Now, I don't know, you know, if that's his calculation or not, but like what are we doing here? This show is not like, you know, this is not the E Network or whatever, like a TMZ or whatever it is. This is not about, like, you know, the what celebrity you like and this and that. This is like these people are all tools. And I don't mean in like the put down way. I mean like
a hammer.
They're all tools. And you don't sit there and say this saw sucks because I can't hammer in a nail with it. That's not the point of the hand. No, I'm not saying that you shouldn't criticize politicians, but I think you got to have an awareness of, like, of you take the value from politicians that you can. If you think you can turn your, if you don't have a hammer and you think you can turn that saw into a hammer, like, I've certainly done that with a screwdriver. I've certainly used like a screwdriver to try and hammer stuff in.
The backside of it.
Of course.
Yeah.
And there's a time and place for that.
Thomas Massey.
There's a time and place for it. But if you don't look at these politicians as tools, if you look at them as, like, I don't know, potential suitor, you know, I don't know, whether life partners.
Whether their soul is getting into heaven.
Yeah, I just, like, you know, I don't understand what you're doing here.
I'm the St. Peter of politics.
Like, what politician do you like? And I don't mean do you like. Like, what politician do you think is is useful. And if there's, you know, I definitely think there's opportunities in appropriate times to push politicians. But I do think that you can also break them in terms of their usefulness to you. And I also think, like, it's also legitimate to critique their decisions and say, I think their assessment of this is wrong, or I think they're no longer helpful to our cause. But to say that Sanders is not helpful to just about any cause that we talk about on this program is, I think, blinkered.
This is reminding me of when I was in college and I was living with a bunch of film majors and we used to watch crappy movies and laugh at them. You realize, like, saying, like, oh, this is how it's not done, that's a lot easier than saying this is how it's done and actually producing something. And the few people who are, like, constantly saying not like that, it'd be much more persuasive to people if you said, actually, this is what I'm doing and this is how it has empowered people, instead of just saying not like what they're doing.
Even if you had a politician to compare it to. Like, yeah. Okay, you don't like what Bernie's doing as a senator. Which senator would you want him to emulate?
Yeah, like, I mean, we've said before, like, I think Tlaib's take an attack on certain things that I prefer to other representatives. But
without,
like,
a doubt.
But again, like, those other representatives, like, this is, there's a continuum here.
And also, I would say there's, like, a utility difference. I think there's just a utility. Like, I mean, I think, like, you know, but Shankfulness, every day Discord is a bet. Who can get Sam to extend the show by 15 minutes? And this IM or one today's pool.
Yes.
All right, three more. Liquid Bread. Northern Indiana defeated data center trying to rezone for building in St. Joseph County. Farmers, local communities, environmental activists, and Northern Indiana DSA banded together to send them packing by the end of the hour of a 10-hour council meeting, 7-2 vote at 4 a.m. Oh, interesting. Maybe we should try and get, like, some of the organizers on that. If you know of any of the organizers, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Say, Indiana Data Center in the subject line. And because it would be helpful to know how folks did that. Mill Rind, Tim Pool's new handle, Soosh with the Douche. And the final IM of the day. Here we go. It comes from former libertarian. War is back on the menu, boys. But seriously, my father tried to convince me I was too hard on Trump and that I should appreciate that he's anti-war. Matt, Brian, Emma, and Abstentia, great job today. See you tomorrow.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot. Somewhere the choice is made, for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I get somehow lost my drive.